bridgeproject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hello, 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 and welcome to The Local Edition, news and information to keep you connected in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. I'm your host for this Tuesday evening, Patricio Robayo. In the second half of the show, we'll be checking in with Marissa Scheinfeld and Isaac Jeffries about the Borscht Belt Marker Project. One is being unveiled this week. But first, in an effort to combat packaging waste and promote recycling, the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act has been proposed. This act aims to hold packaging companies accountable for their environmental footprint and implement significant changes. Under this act, packaging companies will be required to take significant measures within the next 12 years. Another bill known as the Bigger Better Bottle Bill has emerged also, specifically targeting New York's container deposit system. This proposed legislation aims to expand the existing container deposit laws to include a wider range of products. Here to tell us more is Alexis Goldsmith, Organizing Director for Beyond Plastics. Welcome to the program, Alexis. So first, let's get straight into this. How does the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act aim to address the issue of packaging waste?
Well, the bill addresses the issue of packaging head on, that packaging waste is a major problem in our state. Our landfills are filling up. We have 10 municipal waste incinerators. We're exporting thousands of tons of waste to other communities every year. And this is a climate problem and an environmental justice problem. And it's just needless because much of single-use packaging can be reduced. So that's what this bill does first and foremost, is it reduces packaging by 50%. And then it requires companies to redesign the remaining packaging to be less toxic and truly recyclable. And it also requires companies to pay for the end-of-life waste management costs of their packaging, which taxpayers and municipalities are currently footing the bill for.
How will the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act incentivize packaging companies to make their packaging reusable or recyclable?
Yes, the bill uses what we call eco-modulated fees. So the companies are going to have to pay into a fund that will be used to reimburse municipalities for recycling, landfilling, and incinerating waste, because all of those services cost a lot of money. So the companies will pay less if their packaging is better for the environment, like if it's truly recyclable, and they won't pay anything if their packaging is reusable.
One thing I saw in the bill, I'm not sure if this is part of the other bill that we're going to discuss, is the increase of the bottle deposits from 5 cents to 10 cents.
So that's a separate bill. That's okay. The Bigger Better Bottle Bill. But we are hoping that the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act and the Bigger Better Bottle Bill will move together. But yes, the Bigger Better Bottle Bill expands the types of containers that are already covered under New York container deposit law to include wine, liquor, non-carbonated beverages, and nips. And it will up the deposit to a dime.
So let's stay on the Bigger Better Bottle Bill. What impact do you think this will have on low-income New Yorkers who collect and redeem the containers?
Well, it will impact them directly. It will basically give them a very much well-deserved raise. You're right. There are about 10,000 people in New York City alone who are, the profession is called canning, and they're canners, so they collect unredeemed containers and return them for the deposit, and that's how they make their living. Now, they haven't had a raise in 40 years because the bottle bill is now 40 years old and the 5 cent fee was set in the 1980s. So if it had kept up with inflation, that deposit, sorry, I said fee, but it's a deposit. The deposit would be over 20 cents. So the raise to 10 cents is actually very modest, but it will have a huge impact on these folks who are making their living collecting and redeeming containers.
Mm. Just going back a little bit to the Packaging Reduction Act, how would the prohibition of incineration and chemical recycling impact the waste management practice in the packaging industry?
Well, the benefit is that we won't have false solutions for recycling in our state. So chemical recycling is not true recycling. It's an umbrella term for several types of technologies that are promoted by the plastics industry that mainly turn plastic into fuel and other chemicals. Plastic is a petrochemical, so they're turning it back into petrochemicals. But even in the rare instance where chemical recycling is able to turn plastic into plastic, so much of the plastic is lost in the process, between 86% and 99.99% is lost, that it's not, the yield is not enough to really consider it recycling. So our current plastics recycling rate through mechanical means is about 6%. So this isn't going to be improved with chemical recycling. But with chemical recycling, you do get new sources of air pollution, new sources of hazardous waste. You're not getting plastic turned in back into plastic packaging, so you're not reducing the need for new plastics. But you are providing cover to say, well, we've diverted this amount of material, and we're going to consider that recycling. It's not real recycling. We need actual material to material, as in product of material being turned back into its original use. So we're holding very strong on no chemical recycling in the bill. It doesn't ban chemical recycling in the state. It just says that it can't count towards the recycling targets that are in the bill.
You saying that just reminded me of a projected project that was coming here to Sullivan County to help deal with our garbage waste, as the landfill where we take our garbage is going to be decommissioned soon, and the county's trying to figure out what's going to happen with our garbage. And a company came in promising to sort of recycling our garbage and you know, return it into something else, reusable products or reusable raw products to convert it to other things. And a lot of the critics were saying that it wasn't true sort of recycling, because the chemical byproduct of doing the process was also harmful. So it was sort of negating the effort to sort of go green in recycling our garbage. So to me, that's what this sounds like, that there is some byproducts of this chemical recycling.
It's true. There are several reports. There's a really good report from the Natural Resources Defense Council called Recycling Lies, Chemical Recycling is Just Greenwashing Incineration, that lifts the lid off of what's actually going on with these chemical recycling processes. And you're right, they're toxic and they create more toxic byproducts. But you don't have to take my word for it. The National Academy of Sciences recently released a report that is called Reckoning with the U.S. Role in Global Ocean Plastic Waste. And this is a comprehensive, multi-jurisdictional look at the sources of ocean plastic pollution and the solutions. It has several recommendations for the United States in terms of policy to reduce our contribution to plastic pollution, because we are not only the largest generator of plastic waste in the world, we're also the largest plastic polluter in the world. And that report says that chemical recycling is not a proven solution for managing or recycling plastic waste. So that's the National Academy of Sciences saying that chemical recycling is a false solution.
And time is of the essence here. We talked off the air about that the lawmakers are adjourning on June 8th. So you are now in Albany advocating for this. Is that correct?
Yes. We don't have any time to lose. Plastic production is expected to triple by 2050. And much of that production is to create new single-use plastics for packaging. Right now in Appalachia and Texas and Louisiana, in environmental justice communities, fracking is continuing to boom, and new plastics are being made from fracked gases and turned into single-use plastics. So we don't have individual choices are really important, avoiding plastic if you can, but we really need policy solutions to actually require the reduction of plastic use. And that's what this policy does. The Climate Action Council calls for this type of policy to pass this year. In fact, the Climate Action Council calls for the total elimination of single-use packaging. So this bill gets us really close to that. The legislature has a chance to reduce emissions, reduce plastic pollution, protect communities in New York that are affected by landfills and incinerators by passing the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act before June 8th.
Now, we're talking about two different bills here. So how do they work together? How might the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act and the Bigger, Better Bottle Bill work together to create more of a sustainable and environmental friendly packaging system?
Well, the Bigger, Better Bottle Bill, we know that container deposit systems are the best recycling method for beverage containers, and it works better with EPR. EPR is Extended Producer Responsibility. The Packaging Reduction Bill is an EPR bill. It works better with a bottle bill because we don't want the recyclable beverage containers going into single stream. We want to recover them and source separate them, and that's what the bottle bill does. The bottle bill also motivates people to recycle these containers because you get the deposit back if you return them, so they're definitely not going to wind up as litter, or much fewer of them are going to wind up as litter. So there are multi-jurisdictional studies that show that EPR works better with a bottle bill. So that's why we want them to move together.
And you said time is of the essence. Alexis, before we go, is there anything else that we have not touched on do you want our listeners to know about?
I just can't stress enough the environmental justice aspects of both of these bills. The fact that we have 10 municipal waste incinerators in our state, that we have landfills that we're sending waste to other communities to deal with, implies the fact that some people are bearing the burden of waste more than others. They're bearing the air pollution, the truck traffic, the anxiety of living next to a facility like a landfill or an incinerator, and we need to put them first and foremost in how we address the waste crisis. So reducing waste is the best step that we can take to closing landfills, to closing incinerators. And for the bottle bill, the canners who work in New York City, these are people who face barriers to traditional employment. So they might have language barriers, they might have incidents in their past that prevent them from getting traditional employment, and this is their main source of supporting themselves, is returning deposit containers. So we want to support them as well.
We were talking to Alexis Goldsmith, Organizing Director for Beyond Plastics, talking about the Packaging Reduction and Recycling Infrastructure Act, which is Senate Bill 4246 and Assembly Bill 5322, and the Bigger, Better Bottle Bill, which is Senate Bill 237, Assembly 6353. Alexis, thank you so much for joining us on the program, letting us know about these two bills that lawmakers will be deciding upon soon. Thank you so much for talking to us and letting us know about these issues.
Thank you, Patricio.
We'll be right back with Ursa Scheinfeld and Isaac Jeffries, talking about the Borscht Belt, a historical marker project. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Join me, Staff Sergeant Doug Sandberg, for a very special Memorial Day edition of Let's Talk Vets. We'll have a variety of material for you, including some original music and some prose, along with the latest VA updates from Dawn Shaw, Director of Hudson Valley VA Healthcare System, and some news of interest to the Hudson Valley veterans community. That's Wednesday, 7 p.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
Hey there, it's Jason Dole, letting you know that we are having a music sale, yard sale, one day only, this Saturday, 9 to 2, here at Radio Catskill in Liberty. We've got records, CDs, audio equipment, decorative items, media-related oddities, all priced to move. Cash or Venmo accepted. So come find your musical treasure at Radio Catskill, Route 52, Liberty, New York, at the Music Sale Yard Sale, 9 to 2, Saturday. I'll see you there.
And welcome back to the Local Edition. news and information to keep you connected in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. The Borscht Belt Historical Marker Project aims to acknowledge and pay tribute to the remarkable locations intertwined with the lively legacy of the Borscht Belt by erecting informative signage at these significant sites. This project seeks to bridge the divide in local historical accounts and ensure the preservation of Sullivan County's heritage. Here to tell us more are photographers Marissa Scheinfeld and Isaac Jeffries.
Thanks for having us on.
Thank you.
Marissa, I gave a very brief intro exactly what your project is all about, but can you tell us more about the Borscht Belt Historical Marker Project and what is the mission?
Sure. Well, the Historical Marker Project was something that we started last August after a couple of years back and forth with our fiscal sponsor, who's the Jewish American Heritage Preservation. They wanted to put markers in the Borscht Belt. They find people regionally. They put them all over America. And it took a little bit of time to get off the ground, but we're really excited to do this because as of our inception in August 2022, there is not one historical marker in Sullivan or Ulster County that designates and says, here is where the Borscht Belt happened. And it was such a vibrant history, if not a history that really is legendary, that this project is going to celebrate that history in a very strong, tremendous way. We're going to have an extensive marker trail of over 20 markers throughout the county. Our long-term goal is an audio driving tour. And with each marker dedication, and we have one coming up this week, we're going to have public programming that lends itself to the place where the marker is.
And this, the first one is happening this week in Monticello. Where in Monticello?
It's in Monticello. It's in the courtyard at the Ethelbert B. Crawford Library. And the dedication is going to be this Thursday at 4:30 p.m. Following the dedication is going to be a 5:15 screening of the documentary Welcome to Kutcher's, which the marker will honor Kutcher's among other hotels and bungalows. And we're going to have the directors Ian Rosenberg and Caroline Laskow there on hand for a Q&A. And it's going to be a really lovely evening. We hope it to kick off Memorial Day in a way, just like the Borscht Belt, you know, kicked off during the summer.
Isaac, if you could tell us, how does the project select locations for this historical marker? What are the sort of the criteria used?
A lot of different locations that are obviously important to the Borscht Belt beyond the hotels. The towns themselves were like part of the experience. You have these local restaurants that are many times owned by people connected to the hotels or just local families that were in the area for 50 plus years. So we were really taking that into consideration when it came to where we wanted to put the markers. Because when you drive on the road and you see your average New York City historical marker, normally you see it within like 1 millisecond, drive past, accessibility, there's no interaction. Borscht Belt towns, specifically like, I mean, we're starting off with towns that were really, really central to the Borscht Belt, hence Monticello and Fallsburg and stuff. But the point is to really bring the people to experience the towns as well as experience the landscapes where the hotels were. But instead of just highlighting kind of what once was, we want to create, again, like an experience that brings the community together and really has a sort of tie-in throughout the county that shows what was here and solidifies what was here.
Absolutely. Marissa, can you explain how the project uses public spaces and parks and may have accessible locations that will potentially attract foot traffic from locals and tourists coming here?
Yeah, I think for me, I love history. I'm always one that will read a historic marker, but I think the downside to them is that they're often put right on the side of the road in places where you can't easily pull off, and they're hard to read because of that. So when we started out, we talked to a lot of people and really thought out how this could look in the long run. And it seemed to make the most sense to put these in safe, navigable spaces that are already public places that people literally will have to collide with them and walk into them and see them, not go out of their way. So in the sense, we're putting the history in their face in a very kind of visual way. The markers have photographs on them. They're going to have QR codes near them. They're very vibrant and colorful, so they're going to be photographable. And we decided that putting them in these centers of towns where the Borscht Belt transpired made the most sense. And then after you sit and see this dual-sided marker, you could go on to support a local business or go do something in the town, and then really integrate the marker system into Sullivan and parts of Ulster. And our goal, besides telling history, is also to hope to be a part of the economic and tourism revitalization going on.
Isaac, see if you could talk about this. Besides the historical markers, I understand this has different components to it. It's a mostly faceted effort, the Borspiel Marker Project. What else is involved besides the signage?
Yeah, of course. So we're developing like a full-scale audio tour that's going to go along with the visual experience of going and seeing the markers. Obviously, you know, in the audio tour, there's going to be voices that people recognize either from the Borscht Belt or from comedy at large, or just various things that are relating to the Catskills. So it's going to be a real sort of, you know, full-scale experience that brings you in really close, you know, to really what happened, and kind of give you an illusion of kind of how that transpired, you know. And then beyond this, I mean, we're bigger than just markers. We're having a lovely gallery show in August that will be coinciding with one of our marker dedications. It's going to be a lovely show of Marissa and I's work. Marissa makes really, really great work of the Borscht Belt during the day. Many people are familiar with her book, The Borscht Belt, that came out in 2016. So since 2016, I've been making work during the night at the hotels. So fittingly, our exhibit is going to be called Day and Night, Return to the Borscht Belt. And that's just one of many, many different sort of endeavors that we're going to be taking with the project. But the idea is that it's going to be a sort of like a launching pad for other historical projects that they're all going to be Borscht Belt related, but you know, it's bigger than just markers. We have to talk to a lot of people that used to work at the hotels, used to own the hotels. They have really large collections. They want to share them. They want to show them. And, you know, we kind of see ourselves as the vehicle to really show this history to people and bring it to a younger generation and bring it back up from being buried away for so many years.
Marissa, you have photographs. You are a photographer, and you created this book, The Borscht Belt, that revisiting the remains of America's Jewish vacation land. What drew you into this subject matter?
Sure. Well, I guess it goes back to when I was in graduate school and I was looking for a subject to photograph. And that really launched what became a 5-year project that became my first book, The Borscht Belt, where I documented the remaining hotels and bungalows. And I think since the book has come out about 5 or 6 years ago, I've been really fortunate to be continued in that Borscht Belt dialogue, asked to do talks. And I think when I was approached by the Jewish American Society for Historic Preservation, it was just a natural fit because I grew up in Sullivan County. I have many roots there. My family still lives there. And the markers needed really someone on the ground that can be a liaison to the community, also have a sense of legitimacy, you know, credibility. So I do believe that I bring that as well as the rest of the team. Isaac is a phenomenal repository of Borscht Belt information. We also have Louis Ingleterra working with us. He's been looking at the Borscht Belt for over 10 years. John Conway is our co-signer to ensure accuracy. And we also have another Catskill historian on board. So I think really, you know, for me, the Borscht Belt is a topic that I've always been interested in. I'm fascinated with it and its place in American history, Jewish history, Catskill history, but it's personal because I grew up there. I'm a graduate of Monticello High School, worked at some of the hotels as a kid or as a teenager. So it's been part of this lineage of my past, and it continues in a way to be something that I am enveloped in.
Absolutely. And Isaac, how about you? You know, you're approaching the subject matter in a different way. You're approaching it at night. What are your feelings when you walk into a place that, you know, was once grand, once was bustling with people, and now are just left to ruins, and sometimes are just, you know, remnants of it, and some of them are just decayed and broken down?
Well, I'm actually going to jump off the point Marissa just said, because it's just made me think of the perfect answer to that question. I think, you know, within the Borscht Belt, there are so many different sort of takes that you can kind of go with when it comes to the history. There's a very academic sort of side to it where it's very fact-based, and it's interesting. It really is. It makes the mind, like, want to continue to learn more. But then there's also this whole visual side to it in the present and obviously in the past. And that's, I think, where I was really enamored with it before the history, I think. You know, you walk in, even now, you will walk into these spaces that are these ridiculously opulent and glamorous over-the-top rooms, whether they be theaters, indoor pools, lobbies. And I mean, you know, a lot of the resorts obviously have been subject to decay over the past few years, so they've been through it, to say the least. But when I started doing this, I really didn't feel, especially going to the abandoned hotels, I didn't really feel that sort of, I guess, harrowing feeling one would feel when walking into a space like that. I didn't feel scared or upset to an extent, but not really in a sort of depressed way, like upset in the fact that it, you know, just doesn't exist anymore. And I started longing for, you know, capturing that feeling and capturing that sort of, you know, the strings that I hear when I walk into the theater and the, you know, the grand, you know, screams of the crowd, the 1,000-person crowd that was in there, and the bustling voices in the lobby and the children playing and everything. I really want to capture like that feeling visually. And, you know, it's been a really profound experience for me the last few years because I've been doing a lot of this stuff on my own. I really like working alone, especially when it comes to my images. So it's a really sort of, you know, intense moment where it's just me and this room that once, you know, whether it be normally I like to shoot in theaters. So if it's a theater, it's me alone in a room that was designed for 1,500 to 3,000 people. And there's a giant $50,000 chandelier sitting on the ceiling from the 80s. And, you know, it's up to me to basically, you know, light this up and bring it back, you know, back to life. And there's something, it's really hard to put it into words, but it's a really magical experience, especially to have it somewhere as, in my mind, arbitrary as like Sullivan County, New York, you know, it's a really, really magical thing. And, I think that's why this history is so exciting. It's like you don't really know it's there unless you know. And once you know, you're hooked. And I still, to this day, every day, I'm trying to find new places to photograph before they, unfortunately, get demolished.
Now, Marissa, if just remind folks what's happening this week, the fourth marker is going to be unveiled at the Monticello Library on Broadway. What can you tell us? Just remind folks what's actually happening this Thursday.
Yeah, so this will be Thursday, the 25th, this Thursday at 4:30. The dedication will be about 4:30 to 5:15. And after that, we're going to have a free screening of the documentary Welcome to Kutcher's with the directors on hand. We'll have some food and drinks, and it'll really be a wonderful celebration. And I also feel it's very special to be putting the first marker in Monticello. You know, it is my hometown, but also it really was the epicenter. You know, you can call Fallsburg in a way the veins, because Fallsburg also, that's our next area that we're going to tackle. But, you know, really, I think the passing of the era, along with the deterioration and the disappearance of the physical spaces, really signal more than ever that this is a momentous history that is finally departing. You know, people can say, yes, the Borscht Belt is over, but the physical spaces and the people that contributed and were part of it are really finally disappearing. So we feel that it's a profound impact. It has an unbelievable presence in Sullivan County. And we just hope to be a conduit for people to discover its past while we look ahead to all the other exciting things going on in the county.
Absolutely. Before we go, Marissa and Isaac, is there anything else that we have not talked about you want folks to know?
Sure. So Isaac and I are going to have a show in Mountaindale in August. We'll be announcing that soon, but that will be mid-August. That will be a marker dedication and then an exhibit. Then we're going to do one in Swan Lake, also in August, Resorts World in the fall, one in South Fallsburg in the fall. But next spring and summer, we have at least five or six more. We have nine markers in the works right now. So we're about half done with what will be the trail. And if people want to follow us, we're on social media, Borscht Belt Historical Markers on Facebook and Instagram. And our website is maytheborschtbewithyou.org.
That's a great web address. Thank you so much to Marissa and Isaac for joining us. Let us know about the Borscht Belt Historical Marker Project. Thank you so much for joining us. And we hope to have you back on soon as more of these signage and markers go up. And that does it for the local edition. We'll be back tomorrow. We're checking in with River Reporter and Jim Huntington for the economic news. Don't forget to check out our podcast and have a good night, Lucy.
Support comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. Tavern on Main, a neighborhood bar and restaurant on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, featuring local American fare, specialty cocktails, craft beers, and Sunday brunch. Menu and hours online at tavernonmainny.com. And from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, W233AH Monticello. Radio Catskill. Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania.